Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of Dogcast Radio. In this episode, we have part one of our Crufts coverage.
I wish every American could come here and see the wonderful patience that these people display with their parading in the morning, with the on the trolleys and everything, with their dogs, and they just have a very nice, easy way of going.
An article from Ron Hevener. From the moment he first saw it, he knew he was important to this powerful someone. He knew it from the moment he felt his master smile upon him. And the Dogcast Radio News.
Do you have a wading pool in the yard but no small children? Do you always request a doggy bag at restaurants? Are you unable to see out of the passenger side of your windshield because it is covered with nose prints?
This episode's fun facts between items are taken from the book Planet Dog, which we'll be talking about later. But before all that, we have a fascinating interview with Dr. Stanley Coren. We all like to think we know our dogs well. But is it possible that we're only aware of a small fraction of what they're really capable of knowing and sensing? Dr. Coren was researching into seasonal affective disorder and dogs when he came across an unexpected result.
I was preparing for a book project, which has actually now come out. It's a book called Why Does My Dog Act That Way? A Complete Guide to Your Dog's Personality. And in each of my books, I like to put some new data, which hasn't been published in through the standard scientific literature in the book. And we had reports from people, who really tended to believe that their dogs were, in fact, suffering from seasonal affective disorder, that they got mumpy in February and that sort of thing. I decided that I wanted to check that out. If it worked, it would be an interesting bit of data to include with a new book. And it also gave me a chance to try a web-based data collection thing, sort of based on diaries, which I felt might be useful for other purposes. So it all sort of came together, and decided that we enrolled 200 dogs in the study, and they were contacted randomly twice a week during the weekdays. We never contacted them on weekends, and they received a letter, a little email, and it simply asked them, it designated their dog and asked them to rate their dog's activity level and their dog's anxiety level. And we really kept it that simple because we knew that we were going to be getting back to them many times. And so we didn't want to give them a huge burden of really complicated kinds of assessments. And most people do have a pretty good sense as to whether or not their dog is bouncing around more than usual or less, and whether their dog is mumpy or not. So anyway, We ran the data for, 6 or 7 months, bracketing the period when we should get the peak for seasonal affective disorder. And then I did something which is called a running average, which is a way of sort of smoothing a curve, and in order to see whether we get a trend. It's just a statistical trick, but it sort of looks at a window of time, and the bottom line was we got nothing. So, that happens sometimes in science. I thought to myself, well, at least we've proven that the system works. So that's fine. It wasn't a total loss. Anyway, I was shifting computer systems and all that kind of business, and decided to archive some of the data which were set up in the old system. And when I archive data, I do a bunch of sort of pre-processing just so that I could sort of look at it without having to redo the statistics. And one of the statistical analyses which I did just basically plotted each point for on a day-by-day basis, which was not what we were doing because in the previous stuff, because we were looking for trends. And for one day, there was just, there was a point just sort of hanging out over there. I mean, you know, sort of looking like this satellite over all the other points. Mm-hmm. And that was the activity level. And I thought, oh my God, you know, somebody's done, we've got a coding error. You know, somebody, you know, messed up with placing a decimal point or something like that. But then I looked at the anxiety level and, you know, and we had the same point, same day. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I mean, yeah, I have a pretty good crew. I mean, I can imagine them screwing up, you know, on entry on, you know, one day for one point and that kind of thing, but not two. And and so and it was based on a pretty good sample of pretty good subset of the total sample. If people didn't open their email within, you know, on the designated day, then they don't respond. So we always had, you know, some people who were not responding on any given day, but we had 193 out of the 200 dogs responding. Anyway, so I decided, well, you know, we've got these two points, and they're just sort of hanging over there, and, you know, wonder what was going on. Maybe we had a thunderstorm or, you know, or something like that, you know, that made them all spooky, because we don't get very much electrical storm activity out here. So I went back to go, you know, check kind of the meteorological stuff. I mean, that's all that I could think of on this, and tripped across the fact, oh, yeah, that was the day we had the earthquake. I mean, the survey points would have been filled out within 24 hours of the earthquake. And so, I mean, there have been stories of you know, animals responding, you know, predicting earthquakes and that kind of thing. And in fact, you know, the Japanese have a whole big research project going on about this kind of thing. Anyway, so, you know, I then had to sit down and say to myself, well, what's going on in this instance? I mean, you know, does this make sense? And the only thing which I could think of is that maybe, you know, the dogs heard something, you know, heard something associated with the earth movement. Now, there has been some speculation about that, you know. Some people who use, you know, the big search and rescue dogs like the St. Bernards and that sort of thing have often said that dogs respond to subsonics, which are, you know, very long frequency wavelengths, better than we do because, you know, they have big square heads. There was that sort of floating around. Anyway, so I went back to the data, and we had 13 dogs, or 14 dogs, which when we took the demographics of our dogs, you know, the basic information about them, these dogs had, at least the owners felt that they had reduced hearing or hearing losses of varying sorts. And so I thought to myself, well, let's look at those 14 guys. Because if it is hearing, that's a quick and dirty way of seeing whether it is. And sure enough, 13 out of the 14 dogs in that group did not respond, did not show an increase in activity level or anxiety. And the one who did lived with another dog who was normally hearing, but who was not enrolled in the study. So, you know, it began to sound like, you know, his increase may have been because the other dog was going ballistic. So then you have to stop and you say to yourself, okay, is there another way that we can get around this, you know, sort of to test this? And there's a really obvious one, and that is, obviously, a dog who has lop ears, flop ears, have a flap of skin covering their ear hole, right? So, you know, they should have slightly reduced hearing relative to the dogs who have pricked ears. And in fact, you know, we can show that that's in fact the case, and we can measure it for particular sound frequencies. So I went and I divided the sample of dogs up into those which had lopped ears versus those who had pricked ears. And sure enough, the dogs with lopped ears were less likely to have shown the changes in anxiety level and activity level than were the dogs with the pricked ears.
Mm.
So that seemed to confirm that perhaps the dogs were hearing something. But it also runs counter to what other people have been saying. You know, the notion somehow or other dogs respond to subsonics, which is lower frequency sounds. Well, that runs against this ear flap business because the ear flap blocks fairly successfully the high frequency sounds, but doesn't really block the low frequency sounds as well because they just sort of bend around the flap.
Yeah.
And in fact, when you look at the hearing profile of a dog, it's in the high frequencies that dogs really have the advantage over us. I mean, if you wanted to extend the right side of a piano up so that you hit the highest notes that a dog can hear, you'd have to add 52 keys. And the last 28 of those keys would be outside of the human hearing range.
Mm.
Okay, so that makes a certain degree of sense. Then that it would be the high frequencies rather than the low frequencies. Anyway, so I stopped and I said to myself, is there some other way that I can approach this? And it turns out that there is. I have to do it as an approximation because, I had waited several years before going back to this data. As I said, it was just at the point where I was archiving, so I couldn't go back and actually retest the vast majority of the dogs involved in this. But we do know, for example, that animals who have small heads have better sensitivity to high frequency than animals which have bigger heads. So, the bat, for example, can hear way up in the 100,000 hertz range, and we can hear higher frequencies than an elephant and that sort of thing. One of the things which we could do is we did have the breed characteristics of these dogs, and based on breed standards, we could divide the dogs up into large, medium, and small heads, okay, where we're talking about, the overall head size and the width of the space between the ears and that kind of thing. And because this is a fairly sloppy measure, just where does high stop and medium, small stop and medium begin, and where does medium end and large go? So what we did was we divided them up on the basis of thirds, big, medium, small, and throughout the middle. Okay, so that way we get the clearest picture of whether head size really makes a difference.
Hmm.
And when we did that, in fact, it turned out that we did have much more activity in the and much more of a change in the dogs who had the smallest head size. Now, taken together, that's a pretty consistent picture, and it all at least seems to hang pretty well on the subtext that dogs, are hearing in the high frequencies. It would also explain why sometimes, you do get the animal activity and sometimes you don't. You see, the high frequencies would come from rocks scraping and breaking. But the thing about high frequencies is they really don't carry as well as low frequencies. So if you have a deep earthquake as opposed to one where the earth movement is more shallow, then there's a much greater chance that those high frequencies aren't going to make it out, which could explain some of the reason why, sometimes you get this animal activity and sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you got to understand that, I'm presenting this because I thought it was you know, interesting data, and it told an interesting story. But you have to remember, in my heart of hearts, I am still a scientist, okay? And this is a one-shot event. You know, it could be God just sort of, you know, playing tickle me games, you know, and saying, yeah, well, they all fit together this time, but nobody else is ever going to find it. that's the problem with a one-shot kind of a thing. And, you know, my own feelings are that it's pretty damn, suggestive, but, you know, am I going to bet the life of my firstborn on it? No, I don't think so. but you know, there're just too many things, you know, all hanging together on this. You know, the activity level things in general, the deaf dogs, the ear flaps, the head size. I mean, it's just, you know, there are too many things, you know, which seem to glue together to make the picture. At least to me, to make this, you know, much more convincing.
Yeah, yeah. So are you personally going to do any follow-up on this?
Well, if you can predict the next earthquake, then I can start the study going right now. we don't get very many, okay? And this one was located around, you know, around the Seattle area, and we're not too far from there. And so we got, you know, we got movement, we got, you know, chimneys breaking and that sort of stuff. I mean, we got enough so that it was quite clear it was happening. But you know, it's not a, you know, we're not Los Angeles or San Francisco. You know, my own sense is that if somebody is in a region where there is a lot of earthquake activity, and you can get a couple of hundred people who are willing to do a diary study like this, it's certainly worth doing. In this, but am I going to do it again? No, I mean, this was chance finding, and you know, it was not planned. You know, it happened, and so I just felt I could not walk away without telling the story to other people, and you know, and then I get back to my sort of normal human animal bond kind of stuff.
I guess the one thing we can take from this is, if you are going to live in an area that's prone to earthquakes, then maybe you better keep a dog with a small head with the pricked ears.
That's right, that's right, yes. And you guys over there in the UK do that, right? Your fondness for terriers.
Yes. Mind you, we don't get that many earthquakes either, so, you know, it's and they're tiny ones.
No, I know, right? So even though you got the right breed, you got the wrong seismic activity, right?
Yes. Oh well, you can't get it right all the time.
No. I mean, as I said, you know, my own sense on this is that to me, when something all, you know, goes together in this kind of a way, and you know, it's intriguing, and I find it particularly intriguing because it also explains some inconsistencies. You know, if it is the high frequencies, then it does explain, you know, why it doesn't always occur. You know, that to me is, you know, as a scientist, that's comforting.
It's certainly fascinating research.
Yeah, all of this stuff is. I mean, you know, had we found the seasonal affective disorder thing, I mean, that would have been really cute. You know, it would have been wonderful. I mean, you know, if we had another species that we could, you know, use as a model and, you know, working on that for human beings, that would have been terrific. But, you know, we're learning more and more about dogs and about their overall capabilities, and you know, wonderful things have happened in the past two decades, which, you know, we didn't anticipate. And, you know, my sadness is that, you know, I'm going to be nibbling at the roots of the turf when the really exciting stuff is going to be coming out. But, you know, it's nice to have this particular thing. And, you know, we're learning, for example, that, you know, dogs can have certain sensory capabilities which go well beyond anything which we have. For example, right now they have seizure alert dogs. These are dogs which can't anticipate when individuals are going to go into a seizure, sometimes by as much as 20 minutes. Certainly enough time, you know, normally around 5 minutes, certainly enough time for people to sort of get themselves to safety and that sort of thing. And we don't have a clue as to how they do it. I mean, we know how to train dogs to be seizure assistance dogs, so that if a person is having a seizure, you know, they stay close to sort of brace the person. They lie over them to keep them warm and lick at them to keep them conscious and make lots of noise to sort of attract other people. Well, when you train dogs like that as seizure assistance dogs, it turns out that one out of every four or five will spontaneously learn how to anticipate and predict the seizure. We don't have a clue. We don't know whether it's, you know, something happens to the person's, you know, body chemistry, so they're giving a different smell, or they start to move differently, or, you know, we just simply don't have a clue. But, you know, there it is. Well, maybe it's that way with earthquakes. I mean, you know, I think, you know, if I had to bet, I would say it's a hearing thing. But we'll let somebody else who sort of has access to the future data sort of make that decision.
Intriguing, isn't it? If you'd like to find out more about the book that research was done for, Why Does My Dog Act That Way?, there's a link on the Dogcast site. And if you have a dog with strange powers of prediction, do let us know. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Fact from Planet Dog. If you dream about getting bitten by a poodle, you're about to do something foolish.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. You may already know that a very glamorous-looking Tibetan terrier, called a Racky Fabulous Willie, was the Best in Show winner at Crufts 2007. But how much do you know about this amazing dog? Willie first became a champion aged just over 13 months. He was the top Tibetan Terrier for 2002 and 2003, and was also top utility dog in 2003. And he is the only Tibetan Terrier to achieve that. Overall, Willie has won 8 groups, making him the top group-winning Tibetan Terrier ever. And he is the breed record holder with 41 cc's. At Crufts, Willie was best of breed in 2004 and 2006, as well as best in group for 2004. Clearly, Willie deserved his win, and just in case you think he might be a one-off, Willie has sired numerous worldwide champions, so watch out for his offspring.
If you enjoy getting out and about with your dog, you will want to check out the dog events calendar at bringfido.com. Bring Fido is a travel website packed with information about dog-related events, as well as pet-friendly hotels. The calendar lists dog events by state and includes a description of each event along with details on the time, location, sponsor and cost. The best of the best can be found in the top dog events of 2007 section, which features Pup Games at PNC Park, April the 26th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Woofstock 2007, May the 7th in Decatur, Illinois, the World's Ugliest Dog Contest, June the 22nd in Petaluma, California, L'Oreal's Because Your Dog Is Worth It Too Day on August the 18th in Cranbury, New Jersey, and the Fantasy Fest Pet Parade, October the 24th in Key West, Florida. 70% of the dog events featured on bringfido.com benefit charities, so attending is not only a great way to have fun with your dog, but also helps out the less fortunate animals.
And on the subject of being out and about, there is a growing problem in Australia, where some taxi drivers apparently think they can refuse to transport guide dogs. Unluckily for the taxi drivers, one fare they left stranded was guide dog user Graham Innes, who also happens to be Disability Discrimination Commissioner. Graham has had problems in Perth, Sydney and Melbourne, and he urges others who use guide dogs and are refused a taxi ride to lodge discrimination complaints or complain to state government taxi authorities. Refusing to transport a guide dog in a taxi is illegal, and the extent of the problem was highlighted by what happened to guide dog user Peter Elson recently. Peter had flown to Adelaide Airport to give evidence against a taxi driver who drove off without him and his guide dog, and unbelievably another taxi driver refused to take him and his dog. The taxi driver, who the court proceedings concerned, claimed that he was unaware of the law on the subject. However, he had scored 100% on a test about taxi regulations when he gained his license, the same license he lost for 3 years after driving off without Mr. Elson, when he was also given a $2,700 fine. Hopefully, the fact that the problem has now been highlighted in the press will help educate taxi drivers and ensure guide dog users have the access that is their right.
And finally, do you have a wading pool in the yard but no small children? Do you always request a doggy bag at restaurants? Are you unable to see out of the passenger side of your windshield because it is covered with nose prints? If so, you are one of the millions of people who live on Planet Dog. Planet Dog, the first ever doglopedia, features everything that matters most to dog lovers. Tips, trivia, facts, fun, and more. Jam-packed with more than 300 diverse lists about raising, loving, and living in the world with canines, Planet Dog combines practical advice with humorous facts and anecdotes in a colourful and upbeat format.
Included in the pages of Planet Dog are such things as the best dogs for couch potatoes, joggers, or allergy sufferers,
tips for preparing your dog for a new baby,
rules of etiquette for travelling with your dog,
how to evaluate a boarding kennel,
a show dog dictionary,
the best books and films about dogs,
and Celebrity Dog Advocates Hall of Fame.
So, if you already enjoy life on Planet Dog, or if you just fancy a trip there, check this book out. And that's all from us today on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
Fact from Planet Dog. In the 1960s, only a few postage stamps depicted dogs. Today, worldwide, there are more than 4,000 of them, and almost every breed of dog is represented.
Crufts 2007 was the new, improved, bigger-than-ever Crufts. It was also the busier-than-ever Crufts, and at times it was impossible to walk just from the press of bodies. However, we fought our way through the crowds to bring you our Crufts coverage. We'd had some questions from listeners asking for advice, and since Crufts is a huge gathering of dog experts, we decided to take advantage of that. The first appeal for help sounds like quite a cute problem, but I'm assured the novelty has worn off.
Hi there. For starters, I'd like to say thanks for the great and informative podcast. I've been a very big fan. I'm speaking about a 1 year and 6 month old pug. Paul is very active, very well trained, especially with obedience commands. I have no issues with Apollo other than one cute but very annoying issue. He bites toes. Apollo seems to focus in on anyone in the family walking around. He tilts forward and then lunges for the toes with a playful bite. Once started, he basically doesn't let you move. We have tried everything, simply turning our backs on him, saying no, all that stuff doesn't work. Something that does seem to work is telling him to sit. When you do this, he simply sits and waits until you move again and then lunges for your toes. Apollo doesn't always bite toes. It's simply when he gets started, he doesn't stop. We're working more on having him sit and simply waiting longer until he forgets. And this too seems to work a lot better than telling him no or, you know, yelping. Is there any other way that we can bring relief to this toe biting, or do we simply have to live with it? Like I said, we love Apollo, and his toe biting or not, it's fine, but we'll, you know, we wish we can get rid of it. So, you know, thanks.
For help with this toe-obsessed pug, I turned to Gwen Bailey.
The toe biting is his way of playing, and what's gone wrong is that he should have learned by now to play properly with toys. So Peter has said he won't fetch toys, and that indicates to me that they haven't got a very successful toy playing system going. So when Apollo gets excited, he's playing his favourite game, which is the toe nipping. And what we need to do is try and transfer that behaviour onto toys instead. That's why continuous no doesn't work, because what you're trying to do there is inhibit him from playing his favourite game, and there's a very strong motivation behind that desire. And also that's why the sit and wait make more of an impression, because it actually gives him something to do and he's expecting a reward. So it would be perfect if he could get him to sit and wait, but then reward him with toy playing, because that would then make the dog think of something other than toe biting. And that's also why turning your back on him doesn't work, because you're preventing him, all you're doing is you're frustrating his desire to play this game. So what we want to do is teach him how to play properly with toys, and then use that to ask him to sit and wait or not to do the toe biting, and then he'll get rewarded with a good game with a toy that's rewarding for him as well. And eventually you can start transferring that game from the toes onto toys. All right, so the way to do that, wait till he's really excited, and then try to get him so that he runs about after toys. Keep all toes out of the way, or wear strong shoes so that it doesn't matter if he does it, and let him, allow him to do it, but just ignore it. And then really praise and reward him when he shows any attention, pays any attention to the toy at all. From there, you can go on to just make sure it's fun. It's really important to have fun with him. A toy on a rope, like a little ball on a rope, so that you can have one end and he can have the other, will mean that you can play with him, but you can get it back at the end of the game. Otherwise, if he takes it away, he's gone with it, and it takes you ages to get it back. So that's a bit more rewarding for both of you. And really teach him how to play at times when he's not nibbling toes, so that he knows how to do it and has fun with it. And then when you get back into a situation where he's trying to go for your feet, just ask him to sit and wait for just a short time, just maybe a few seconds at first, and then produce the toy and have a really good game with him. And then you can gradually build up the time that he's sitting and waiting for and being good, and then reward him later at the end. So that will do it. It's a nice positive way of teaching him to play the games, but to play them in a better way than the games that he's playing now. Just remember that every time he gets really excited, he'll want to play his favourite game. So, and that needs to be play with a toy instead of play with toes.
I imagine it gets quite a big response as well. If he's nibbling your toes, you're going to be sort of dancing around, no. So again, it's that response, isn't it? Do you think that's feeding why he's doing it?
Yes, definitely. It'll be making him more excited, and when he gets more excited, he wants to play the game more. So the way to tackle that, really, if the best thing to do is stand still and just ignore it, and then try using the toy technique. But if you can't ignore it, maybe have a little house line on him so that you can pick up the house line and actually physically stop him. That means you don't have to get excited yourself. You can just stand there and control him. Or wear shoes around the house so that it doesn't have any effect on you, and you can just stand still and wait for him to stop. When he stops, get the toys out, play a little game, and then he gets rewarded in a different way.
Cruft attracts a worldwide interest, so we dropped in on the American Kennel Club stand to find out what they were doing at Cruft's.
This is Michael Canalizo. I'm the director of AKC Event Management.
Right. Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Great. How are you? So what are you here promoting at Cruft's?
Well, the American Kennel Club puts on their national championship show every year, which invites all the top dogs from almost all the recognized registries. And all the best of breed winners and best of opposite winners of every breed becomes eligible to be entered at the AKC Yukonubit National Championship. So now with all the opening of the pet passport and things, we're getting a huge amount of international competition, which, you know, is great for everybody, because so many people get to see dogs that they've never seen before. And we're here to help make arrangements for these people and you know, show them the path to making an entry and making sure, if they've never traveled abroad, how they can get the right medical veterinary clearances, things like that.
Right, okay. And how
does Crufts compare with American dog show, sort of with the Westminster show, or, you know, how does it compare?
I wish every American could come here and see the wonderful patience that these people display with their parading in the morning, with the on the trolleys and everything with their dogs, and they just have a very nice, easy way of going, and they don't complain. I mean, luckily you've had wonderful weather this weekend, so it's been excellent. We hold our show in California in December, which is probably the best climate of the time. A lot of people who come because it's also a great time to take in a vacation as well. Crufts is, the concept of the bench show is very appealing because the people are there for the public to see.
Yeah.
You know, ours is a televised event very much like Crufts, and we have such common goals with education and breed health programs, and so we think the Kennel Club and the American Kennel Club have a great deal paralleling each other. So this event is by far exceeds us in number. It's been 10 years since I've been here last, and I've seen some great strides in presentation of the various breeds and condition, performance, and it's been a lovely experience, you know, a lot of people showing interest in coming to our events, and it's the world's coming smaller,
yeah.
Obviously, because Crufts have had some international competitors that have been very successful. Other people have taken notice. So it's a very positive thing for all people involved.
I think with Crufts, it's sort of, you've got the show rings and the very formal kind of side of it, but you've also got I like to see the informal side, you know, after they've gone into the show and they come out and they're just sitting with the dogs waiting and that sort of side of it.
Well, exactly. That helps for the public's awareness.
Yeah.
I mean, people still come to support a purebred dog event because they want something specific. And if they want the kind of dog that's going to bring them the paper every morning or go run in the pond or help them walk aside them if they're a hunter, that's fine. But some people want a dog that's just going to sit on the sofa and look beautiful. And this way they get to familiarize themselves, and hopefully the people tailor the right dog to the right kind of household, and by virtue of interacting, this gets done.
Yeah.
You know, it's a much, people would, they're consumers. They'd rather see and touch what they're going to buy than do it online or on the net, which is a positive thing. You can see the type of person, or you can build a relationship. Building relationships is so important, whether you're going to future as a breeder or just as somebody who has. I have people that have had 3 generations of human beings owning our dogs, and you know, they know exactly what they're going to get, and it's very important for us to represent the purebred dog for that reason. And there's so many choices.
Yeah, yeah. There's a dog for everybody, isn't there?
Absolutely. And then every one time when you think you've seen it all, I found a breed that I'm walking past and I just looked at it and it smiled at me, I smiled at it, and I said, oh, I could live with this every day. And I couldn't pronounce the breed if I wanted to, but I'll never forget it.
Then it was time to get some answers for Dogcast listener Sarah.
Hello, Julie, this is Sarah Ernst. So my question was, I was dog sitting for a Labrador Retriever who was very sweet and loving, friendly dog, but she seemed to be constantly worried or on edge about something. So have you come across any suggestions for calming techniques for anxious dogs?
For help with this one, I spoke to Hilary Self from Hilton Herbs.
We've had a question from a listener who pet sits a dog that's quite an anxious dog. Now, she's asked for tips on how can we help our dogs be calmer. If they need to calm down, what can we do for them?
I think, I mean, obviously what I'd have to do is I'd have to give a sort of generic answer for this.
Yeah.
But generally, if somebody phoned or emailed us with a helpline question, then I would want to ask a lot more questions. I mean, you'd need to get the background of the dog. Had it had bad treatment? You know, what the situation was in the home, perhaps even what the dog was being fed, because obviously diet can be a big influence on pet behaviour. But without those sorts of answers, I think what I would probably suggest is trying to tackle it perhaps from a mental aspect, thinking about one of maybe the flower remedies that could be used. because the flower remedies are for very specific conditions. So, I mean, if I felt that the dog was fearful, if it was like a phobia, then maybe you'd want to try using something like, you know, cherry plum or mimulus. If the dog was having a panic attack, maybe something like rock rose. But there's also herbs that you could use. Generally, valerian and skullcap are the two probably most commonly used herbs. For things like hysteria, you can even use them for dogs that have epileptic fits even. But the beauty of the herbs is that they're not going to actually dope the dog, which you don't want, because you don't want the dog to feel disadvantaged even more, particularly because then you can get sort of fear biting and this sort of thing. But I would use herbs that I would use on a person who was anxious in the same way. I would use things like chamomile, vervain, valerian. I mean, we do a mix called Tranquility, which has those herbs in it, which will work on strengthening and calming the nervous system rather than suppressing it. And the feedback that we get from people is that the dog is less influenced by what's going on around it. It's more focused and less, you know, less agitated. And very often, even with, say, rescue dogs, you can use something like that for them so that they can gain confidence and be less alarmed by, you know, by new things. But the thing to remember with anything herbal is that you're looking at it taking at least sort of 3 weeks to get into the system and then, you know, to start to have the effect. But you can very often, as I say, do a combination. You could use herbs, you could use homeopathy, you could use batch flower remedies, and obviously you could use sort of behavioural techniques as well. So, as I say, you'd perhaps normally need to go into quite a lot more detail on the background of why the dog was like this. You know, is it an anxiety, is it separation anxiety from its owner, etc., etc.
So obviously you do it on a specific basis with each dog, but those are things which may well help.
Exactly, yes. I mean, each dog, like any person, is an individual, and you have to take into consideration its past history and its personality. You know. So, but if you're looking for a sort of a general supplement that I would use in those sort of circumstances, it would probably be something that would have those herbs in it.
We all know dog theft is a growing problem. But behind the statistics are some heartbreaking stories. We spoke to Margaret, who founded Dog Theft Action after the loss of her own beloved dog.
It's actually 4 years yesterday since my Astrid was stolen from my garden in North Lincolnshire. She's a little Blenheim Cavalier, and she was taken out of the garden while my husband and I were actually working there. And I mean, dog owners, dog lovers will appreciate, I was absolutely devastated. It was a member of my family. I'd had her for 7 years, and I'd nursed her through all sorts of illness. And it was just dreadful, and I just became aware that, you know, there was not really a great deal of cooperation and coordination going on, in, you know, to help me in my search. I mean, yes, I met some very genuine people, and they were very helpful. But I was having to chase around contacting five local authorities, you know, five lots of dog wardens, five lots of rescue kennels, five lots of police stations, because of where the boundaries fell near my home. And I thought, there's got to be a simpler way of doing this. And I contacted various like-minded people, some of them victims of dog theft themselves, and we got together, and that's how Dog Theft Action was formed.
And so how do you actually help people? How do they?
Well, basically, we provide a support. So if anybody finds themselves in this situation, they can log on to our website or they can contact me by phone. And, you know, we'll advise them what to do. We've got a specific page to advise people. I mean, the main thing when your dog goes missing is publicity. Absolutely. To get, you know, information about the dog on the radio, on the TV, in the press. Get posters up all around, you know, the area and beyond. There are various websites that you can contact for help. Of course, you should always contact the Pet Log Reunification Service. That's the main one. Even if your dog isn't actually microchipped, you should contact them in the first instance. You must let the dog warden know, if your local dog warden know, if a dog's gone missing. And you need to report it to the police and make sure that you get a crime number, because if you believe a crime has been committed, then you need to report it and you need to have proof that a crime has been committed. The dog may actually turn up at some stage in the future, so you need that report and you need that number to cross-reference. It's absolutely crucial. We actually provide information on responsible pet ownership with regards to dog theft. So not doing things that are going to make your dog vulnerable, not tying it up outside a shop, not leaving it in a car. I mean, under any circumstances, it really isn't worth it because of the grief that it causes. Being very careful when you're out walking the dog, you know, we tend to want to share our dogs with people. We tend to want to be so friendly. But at the end of the day, it's best to keep the information to yourself, not to let your dog run out of sight. All this information is available on our website, www.dogtheftaction.com. All that information is there, and you can read stories from, you know, other victims or people that are interested in the subject. You don't actually have to be a victim of dog theft to be a supporter of Dog Theft Action. You can help us, you know, by spreading the word, by you know, discussing things with the vets, with your MP, anybody who will listen that can have an impact on the situation.
Well, the thing is, you may not be affected by dog theft yet. You may never be affected, but if you've got a dog,
yes,
the chance is there, isn't it?
The point of us being here at Crufts is to actually bring this message to a wider audience, and this is relevant to every single person in this centre this week.
Yeah.
No, people are here for a reason. They're here because they want to know about dogs, they want to see dogs, they want to appreciate dogs, but they need to consider the potential for dog theft. At the moment, the odds are very much in favour of the thief. And so we actually need to join together. Dog Theft Action ethos is cooperation and coordination. And we need to actually start working, building an infrastructure that makes it very difficult for dog thieves to carry on, you know, their absolutely disgusting trade.
Yeah. And you've got a raffle going at the moment, haven't you?
We've got a raffle going, yes. And it's a super raffle as well. Very talented artist who is a supporter of Dog Theft Action, a chap called Paul Doyle. He's given us paintings before, but this year he's donated a commission. So the winner of this raffle will actually be able to get a painting of their own dog done worth £2,000, which is absolutely fantastic to have an opportunity like that. Tickets are £2 and they will be available after Crufts on the Dog Theft Action website.
That fantastic raffle prize is on offer worldwide. So we went to speak to artist Paul Doyle, who could be painting your pet if you buy a ticket.
You're offering the prize for the Dog Theft Action raffle, which is...
I am, yeah.
And so anybody in the world can, if they win the raffle, they can send you the photo of their dog.
Yeah.
And
The photos we've specified in the raffle, they have to be, you know, eye level, outdoors, and it's just for one dog. It wouldn't be for multiple dogs on one picture, because the picture's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So. Yeah, but that's it.
Yeah. There's some beautiful photos. Well, beautiful pictures of dogs.
Very much.
Do any of them, is there a story attached to any of them? Do they jump out at you with them?
I always like to do pictures that aren't just portraits. I like to do pictures that tell a story, like, you know, staff party, a group of staffs with some drinks. And I always try to do that so that the pictures have a narrative, a story, rather than just a straightforward portrait. And I find that people like that. So, and I'll probably do that with this picture as well, you know, the winners. I'll think up something, because it just makes it more fun for me and for them, you know. So, yeah.
That's gorgeous, the Labrador in the snow.
Thanks very much. Yeah. That's that lab in the snow. He's called Snowplow. He was actually photographed in long grass. But I just like the idea of putting him in snow, so I changed it.
Well, our Labrador loves snow, so that's got the ring.
They do. I think all dogs do. Until it gets all stuffed between their paws, and then they can't.
Yeah, and they go sort it out.
They're
beautiful. The Scotty under the newspaper as well.
Beautiful. It's called Highland News. That.
If you'd like to check out some of Paul's artwork, you can find it at dogart.com. If you do buy a ticket, your money is going to a very good cause. It's difficult to imagine the suffering and misery dog theft causes, and anything that helps stop it is worth supporting. One cause Dog Theft Action is promoting is the Jester's Law campaign. Jester's story is not a pretty one, and while I spoke to his owner Nicky, I have to admit I was fighting not to cry. What Nicky went through is horrific, and it began on an ordinary walk in the woods.
He vanished. We believed that thieves lured him away with a bitch, and then when they realised he was neutered, dumped him on the A1, where he was hit and killed. but the highways agency who collect the body took it away and incinerated it, but they didn't scan him for a microchip. So I actually found the remains on the side of the road, which I collected and sent to America for a DNA profile, which came back as positive. But if they had just scanned his body at the side of the road, then I would have known.
That's an awful, I mean, it's not bad enough you've lost your dog, but then to have to go through that, that's horrendous.
It is. They've now actually had a meeting with them, and they've now bought scanners across the whole of the UK, and they have got refrigeration facilities, but it's by no means law, and they're doing it on a voluntary basis, so we need it to be made law. We're also asking the local government authorities, because dogs who are killed on council roads more often than not just end up on landfill sites and they're not scanned. So we're asking that every single dog, whether it's dead, alive, stray or injured, is scanned for a chip and check for a tattoo before it's removed or incinerated or treated.
I mean, any dog lover listening to that, that has got to move you and motivate you to support this law, hasn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, there's supposed to be 150,000 people coming through Crufts over the next, all these 4 days. You would think every single person would want to sign this. I mean, even if you haven't got a dog yourself, you can't fail to want to come and sign this petition, definitely. And then there's an online petition as well. If you go onto the Dog Theft Action website, you can actually sign the petition online as well.
You can sign the petition to support Jester's Law no matter where you live. And I think you'll agree that if it stops other dogs suffering Jester's fate, it's a few minutes well spent. We'll be bringing you part two of our Crufts coverage in the next episode.
Fact from Planet Dog. The Boston Terrier is considered a big barker, the Basset Hound is a big drooler, and the German Shepherd Dog is the gassiest dog.
And now, His Master's Smile. Written by Ron Hevener, read by Julie Hill. He had won. He had done his master proud, and he had won. It wasn't that he understood exactly what he had done to make everyone so happy. It wasn't as if he had fought off a raging bear or saved a lost child. He hadn't run for help or chased a thief away from those he loved. He hadn't done any of those things. He hadn't done anything but be himself, standing before a crowd of strangers, beside the one he loved. And there it was, his master's hand upon his shoulder, his master's voice at his ear, his master's smile upon him. It wasn't always like this. In the long-ago mists of before, when he nudged his mother's breast and scrapped with his brothers and sisters, he was blind to the life that lay ahead of him, blind to anything but himself. Listening into the night, his mother's breath comforted him in a world of what he could feel, hear, or sense around them. But from his earliest awakening, he was aware of a presence around him, an intelligence. From as far back as he could think, there seemed to be a mysterious something watching over them, providing an order to things. A mysterious someone who seemed to care. Day after day it was like this. Day after day, as he dozed in the manner of the newborn, he felt himself touched by something greater than he himself seemed to be. It wasn't that he knew himself. It wasn't as if he knew he was any different from a rock or a tree or the flowers decorating his life. He only knew that his life was protected by someone that could change anything around him. It was a power that could change the bedding on which he lay. It could bring him food. It could bring water. It could take away his mother, making him wonder if she would ever return. It could fill the air with music all night long and calm him with a reassuring voice. From the moment he first saw it, he knew he was important to this powerful someone. He knew it from the moment he felt his master's smile upon him. As it is with all young dogs, there were ups and there were downs. There was the time he escaped and followed a yellow butterfly. Yes, it was true he could hear his name being called. It sounded nice, hearing his master shout his name to the heavens and fade into the distance. But a yellow butterfly, now that was something he had to know about. He had to know about all kinds of things in the early days. He had to know about powdery wings that fluttered and lifted a butterfly into the air. Did he have wings too, he wondered. Where were his own wings? Where, he suddenly wondered,
with a sinking feeling in his belly, was his master's voice. Yellow butterflies melted into darkness and shivers as he learned the meaning of loneliness and longing. A light, the rustling, crunching sound of dry leaves and familiar footsteps. Was it possible? "There you are," came the words that showed him all things are possible, even when all is lost. "I've been looking for you," came the caress of love as they turned for home, and he felt his master's smile upon him. There were other times, many of them, when he tried new things. Some were praised, and others were not. But through it all, through the good times and the bad, his spirit flourished, and he grew. As his spirit grew, so did the body in which it dwelled. He grew taller, stronger, and wiser, with his master never far away, feeding him, watering him, turning on the radio and filling the night with music. With his master's help, he grew to understand that collars, leashes, and manners were important things to know about. He grew accustomed to riding in a car, accustomed to the slippery floor of a veterinarian's office and the bitter taste of medicine. He grew accustomed to many things to please the one he loved. There were others like his master. As time went by, he saw many of these gods, for that's what they were to him. He heard them speak and did not understand their words. He saw their eyebrows raise and fall. He saw the gesture of their hands and felt their laughter. "Is that thing worth showing?" they asked. "We'll see," came the answer from the one who mattered to him most. "His mother is the best one I have, and his sire is a winner." A spring burned into summer, and summer leaves began to fall. They worked. They worked together, side by side, early in the morning. They roamed the pasture and fields, just the two of them, a master and his dog. A master and his dog sharing a secret. "You can do it," he was told. "I know you can." After what seemed like endless mornings and endless nights, when it felt as if this would be his lot in life forever, something changed. "We've done enough now, my friend. It's time to show them." Show them? Show them what? What are we going to show them? "We're going to show them what you were born to be," came the answer, as he felt his master's smile upon him. He was frightened that day. Was he good enough? Would he do the right thing, or would he let his master down? What was ahead for him, he wondered, as he hopped into the car. Were they going to the vet's office? Please say they weren't going to the vet's office for shots or medicine. But they weren't going to the vet. This time, they drove past the vet. He breathed a sigh of relief and fell asleep. It was the sounds that woke him. Sounds of barking, air compressors, and excited chatter. The smell of sausage, French fries, and dogs. Hundreds of them, more dogs than he had ever seen in his life, lured him to full attention. "Where are we?" he wondered, pressing his nose against the window. "What's happening?" "Come on, fella," his master said, opening the door and snapping on a leash after they came to a stop. "Good boy." Good is what he always tried to be. Was it his imagination, or was his master standing extra tall today? Was his master brushing him with extra careful attention? Were people looking at them in a different way than they used to? "Where do you get that one?" somebody with a poodle asked. "Bred him myself," came the answer. "Yeah? Who's he out of?" "The best one I have, and his sire's a winner." "Wait a minute," came a voice of disbelief. "That can't be the one I saw at your place. That pup that was just about the scrawniest thing I ever saw." Nobody had ever told him he was scrawny. Nobody had ever told him he was any different from a flower or a cloud or a beautiful butterfly. Nobody had ever told him anything, except that he was important, except that he was loved. The class was called, the entries filed into the ring. Proudly he stood as the judge ran her hands through his hair, over his back and down his legs. Down and back they trotted, round the ring they went. As still as a living statue he stood, though every fibre of his being wished to jump into his master's arms. One by one, the entries went through their paces. One by one, they went to the end of the line. One by one, they waited the judge's brave decision. "Around again, please," she directed. And, sure of herself, she pointed. "One, two, three, four," as the crowd clapped their approval. No, it wasn't as if he understood exactly what he had done to make everyone so happy. It wasn't as if he had fought off a raging bear or saved a lost child. He hadn't run for help or chased away a thief. He hadn't done any of those things. He hadn't done anything but be himself, standing bravely before a crowd of strangers, standing beside the one he loved. There it was, his master's hand upon his shoulder, his master's voice at his ear, his master's smile upon him. And that was His Master's Smile, written by Ron Heavener, read by Julie Hill.
Fact from Planet Dog. According to superstition, if a newborn baby is licked by a dog, then the baby will be a fast healer.
From the 6th of April, it will be illegal to dock dogs' tails in England. This law will also be in effect in Wales and Scotland. Working dogs can still be docked in England and Wales, but in Scotland, the ban applies to all dogs. Things get really interesting, though, when it comes to foreign show dogs coming to England to compete. Because dogs docked before the 6th of April can compete, but if they are docked after the 6th of April, even if it's done in a country where it's legal, they cannot compete in England at shows where the public is charged an admission fee. Now, the ins and outs of this law are complicated, but that's the bare bones of it. So, what do you think of this? Is it fair or not? Should the UK be taking this stance on foreign dogs? Is it a good thing for dogs, or is it just plain meddling? Is there a good case for docking working dogs? Tell us what you think. Now, that law is for serious dog shows. What about fun dog shows? Do you have them where you live, or is this a British phenomenon? A fun dog show is where dogs of any parentage can compete, and would involve categories such as waggiest tail, dog the judge would most like to take home, and dog and owner who most resemble each other. If you do have fun dog shows, let us know. And if you don't, maybe you should start, because they really are fun. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
When it's raining cats and dogs, what should you do? Try not to step in a poodle.